This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 8th of December, 1954. The title of this lecture is Rundown on Six Basics. This tape is 70 minutes long.
We're going right in here for blood on the subject of these basic six processes. Give them a very, very fast spin. You've heard of them. You know something about them. We're going to give them a fast spin through just to make sure that you are cognizant of them. You are going to be expected to train people. When you train people in Dianetics or Scientology today, that is the branch of this science which is applied to man. You see, any place Dianetics or Scientology was applied to man, boy, you really got to know those six processes. This is so much the case that you, in training somebody to a grade, because you'll undoubtedly be granted the right to train, in training somebody to the grade of HCA or HDA, they can have those degrees at their election, you will be expected to expect of them perfect performance on the basic six processes. Now, that is so much the case that today Bob is sitting down there, just taken over as director of processing, has instructions and is carrying out these instructions, that any preclear who walks in through the front door of the HDRF or HASI shall have run upon him the six basic processes and nothing else. And that is so rigorous that if an auditor brought in to audit an HASI preclear were to depart from these six processes, he would forfeit his fee. It's just bluntly that. I mean, he just forfeited. No argument concerning this. Why is this? Because we have found out uniformly, clear across the field from one end to the other, in various continents, so on, that where it comes to living, breathing man, these six processes, regardless of any theory or rationale that you could apply to them, these six processes crack cases and exteriorize people. Now, there are 75 processes, but all these 75 processes are variations on these six processes, one way or the other. Very fascinating here that we have six processes which, in the hands of auditors, working on miscellaneous, preclears, odds and ends, everywhere, produce results. Now, you take it this way. You take a poll of preclears. Let's take a big poll of preclears who have been run a long time in Dianetics and Scientology. See, we take this big poll. Maybe these people have had 25, maybe they've had 50, maybe they've had 200 hours. Maybe they've had a lot of old-time auditing and, you know, we're back book one. And we take a poll of these people, and what do we discover? We discover that their case took a change on some odd process or another. They'll mark down some odd process. Their case took a change, you know, black and white processing. Got a mark change on this. And then they will mark down one of the basic six or all of them. Then you look at the next sheet, next check sheet on a system like this. You look at that. You find out that they got some kind of a random change when they were run on Gita, expanded Gita. Gita applied specifically to money. They got quite a change on the case with this. They remember they did this. But the major change on the case occurred with one of the basic six processes. As we go across the boards, we discover that the common denominator processes, two preclears who had received change from auditing, are the basic six. Those are the common denominators. It's that level. Those processes are very important because they represent themselves a tone scale of processes. And they're very precisely placed on the tone scale, and the various variations of these six processes make up all the auditing there is. But these six processes, done in a completely pure, unaltered state, have uniformly produced results on preclears. We can, with great confidence then, have a preclear walk in front door at the HASI, signing to an auditor, start supervising this auditor, make sure that this auditor goes through, make sure he picks up all the pieces, and that he makes no boo-boos on the basic six processes. And we know at the end of a period of time, and remember that period of time can vary preclear to preclear. It varies as the preclear goes further on down the tone scale, the time goes longer. But because you're working on basically time factors, we can be sure that at the end of the assigned period of time, whether that assigned period of time was 12 hours or 50 hours or 180 hours, that we will have a very markedly changed individual. Not necessarily true that these processes used on students by students do a great deal for a case. This is not necessarily true. Students are able to enter in enough randomity, enough interesting curlicues, quirks, knocking over beds, falling out doors, being bored with a situation, having just been audited themselves. They're in a chronic state of restimulation as they're trying to audit somebody, and their interest in the case is very poor. But that isn't the main thing that holds up student auditing. The main thing that holds it up is all the students know that all the students are students. And that's what holds it up. We have this factor with us always in any class or any unit, any class. It should be present, much less so, in a unit like this, where everyone is pretty well trained, had a lot of auditing background. The point that we will find going astray in a unit like this is too much experience and too much conviction. And we will occasionally find somebody who, well, the auditor knows, and probably quite rightly, exactly what will crack the case in terms of 1952 processes. He knows he's cracked cases with this, and he'll run this process, and you will find his student preclear, who is also a student, knows that is not what has been assigned, and of course will freeze up, say this auditor is incapable of following instructions, and he will consider this a huge boo-boo, and quit. And then everyone is very alive and very alert to the auditor's code, and you would have to work like mad to break the auditor's code on the average preclear. Should pull off the street. You just have to work hard to break an auditor's code. You'd have to really be flagrant. I've seen auditor code breaks reported which consisted of, he sneezed. It was a code break. He really broke the code because he refused and wouldn't run the process that he should have been running that week, regardless of what the auditor thought the preclear ought to have run on him. You see, this auditor was supposed to be auditing something or other, and he didn't audit this on this preclear, and this preclear knew he should have been auditing this, so the preclear says, aha, an auditor code break, he's not running the right process. Everybody's training everybody all the time. Everybody has a big critical idea of everybody all the time, and so you get a very peculiar brand of auditing. You see auditing at its very worst in one of these units. Anybody who joins a unit to get processing, if he isn't crazy to begin with, is liable to be at the end of the unit. But the funny part of it is, the very, very funny part of it is there is no substitute for going through one of these units and watching all of the boo-boos and having them happen and unhappen and so forth. If an individual stays with it, he recognizes several things. And one of those things is that bad auditing doesn't necessarily butcher him. It takes the importance off of this. Instructional auditing doesn't necessarily kill him. And he finds out at once how bad auditing can be and what a thoroughly upsetting result you can sometimes get by auditing something incorrectly. He discovers that subjectively, which is a very interesting way to discover it, and practically the only way there is to discover it. And the other thing that he learns, of course, is the reverse of that, that even though it is very bad, it still won't kill him. This is heartening. Now, you take a unit such as this, there isn't a person present here who hasn't been pretty well trained one way or the other, who isn't pretty well conversant with the old time methods and various things like that. And most everybody is fairly wise about these new processes we've been using, and even some here have been very thoroughly trained in these six basic processes. So therefore, our job is primarily to make good auditors. You get the idea. That's our job. Now, it wouldn't matter how good a fellow was He could always be a better auditor. Now, I'm always, when I'm 10 feet back of my head auditing somebody, I'm always aware of the fact that I could be doing a better job of auditing. I can pick up my own flaws and quirks and things I do wrong and correct them and carry them around. I was doing a job of auditing just before I came to class here, for instance. And I was a little bit abstracted because there are several very pressing items which are waiting just outside the door and dropping my lap, and several other things were going on. And I suddenly recognized that I was not doing, and that I had been consistently doing, one error in auditing. If you want to do a perfect job of auditing, or even close to perfect, there are several various little rules to follow. And one of them is, every moment is separate from every other moment. He wanted to find sanity. Sanity is a state in which every moment is separate from every other moment. Insanity is a state where all moments are the same moment. Got that? That's a very handy definition. All right. Now, when we say to a preclear, let's look for some things, the way we have to do, see, in group processing. Let's look for some things which aren't going to eat you, and, you know, just make him look at the walls or something. And he does, silently. He checks over, you see that he's checking over, and then you say, give me some more things, and you do this in an individual session, you're wasting one of the primary things in individual auditing. An individual auditing can monitor each and every individual preclear. And in monitoring each and every individual preclear, we discover that each instant is going to be separate from every other instant. Each and every second, each and every instant is a separate instant. You see that stuff over there, a wall? Do you know that that thing actually and basically is there all the time because all instants are there? It's because all of its instants are the same instant. That wall is forever. That isn't a thin strata on the time track which is moving forward in time along with you. This is quite a basic and interesting discovery if you can grasp it. It always has been there. It always will be there as far as the unit materials are concerned. It hasn't got any time. That's the trouble with it. And if you can tolerate something which is a total time, you can't get back of the time of that wall. You can't get forward of the time of that wall, you see? Because that wall is a forever. You see that? Now, just reverse your ideas of time, thinking that that wall is giving you a time track by ticking off and moving. No, no, the only way you ever get any time at all is by making a consideration there is time. You go on considering there is time, why you go on considering there is time? But this wall, I know those orbits travel around in very precise waves and all of that sort of thing, and it all seems to be perfectly timed. This is highly questionable. That is terrifically theoretical. Do you know that nobody has ever watched the L orbit of anything? No, nobody's ever seen this. They see the Earth go around the Sun on a time basis, and they change every week. Certainly oftener than a lot of these nuclear physicists change their underwear. They change their theory about the structure and formation and motion of the atom. It's curious, it's weird. Because they've been going on the basis that time comes off of that wall. That's why people are daffy. That's why people in the sciences, in biology, that's why they think man comes from mud. And all the rest of it. They think time comes off this matter, this space. They think it does the timing. No, it doesn't. Not even vaguely. The only thing that does any timing is life. And if you can look at this and you understand it, you've got a reverse look, really, at what has been the popular scientific concept. We see the sun rising and setting, so therefore we know time has occurred. Well, it'd be all right if we didn't have that word no in there. If we said the sun is rising and setting and therefore time has occurred, we're utterly incorrect. The sun is rising and setting and therefore we know time has occurred is correct. No time has occurred. We have occurred. Action is taking place. If you see this clearly, it's a little bit hard to grasp. You have to kind of get audited into it sometimes. But all of a sudden it becomes very clear. You say, holy cats, time is a consideration. You look at this stuff around here. Let's go glunk. Now, one of the things is time has assumed an automaticity as far as science is concerned. Science believes that time is this terrific automaticity. See? And if the sun is going around its axis and the earth is going around the sun, and that this automaticity finally enforces time upon us. And if you want to get a hold of an e-meter or do some remembering, you will discover planet builder incidents, system builders. It's quite curious. Life has actually agglomerated the material which makes up the sun and the earth. They have set these things into motion. They have been set into motion. They are energy which is being swung by life. And if life took no further interest in it of any kind, it wouldn't go on swinging. Believe me. Science has taken a backwards look at this. It's a little bit hard at first, maybe, to grasp the fact that time is a consideration, but let's look at it this way, and you can see it immediately. An individual begins to depend more and more upon clocks, watches, the passing of the sun. He begins to believe more and more that these things are giving him a timing, that they are delivering into his hands a timing. And he goes nuttier and nuttier. Let's watch that one. Why? He gets more and more jammed. He has less and less time. You can see that one take place. Just take somebody who has been utterly dependent on clocks or even the sun, and we take a look at him and we find out that he is not the free spirit which he once was. See, the more we depend upon the messed universe to give us time, the nuttier we get, the less decision we have. Why? Because it has abrogated to itself a function which can be performed only by life, you see. Life keeps giving it this function, says, look, this is time. Life gives it the function in order to have an agreement on time passage, so that you and I both know what time you and I are in. It doesn't have anything to do with it. You and I agree that there's time passage going on. We say, look at this motion which we've started here. All right, now as this motion keeps taking place and so on, we will consider that a motion is taking place. You and I will both consider this motion is taking place, and therefore at this uniform rate, which we have both carefully concentrated on and so forth, will be a rate of agreement on which you and I can talk, converse, or shoot at each other. You understand this, then, that the less an individual is in control of, the less an individual depends upon some other exterior force to give him time, the more difficult this individual's case is. You just look at your worse-off pre-clears and you'll find out that it's impossible to get them there for appointments. They just slop all around. A psychotic one. He doesn't know whether it's midnight or Christmas. You told him to come in at 2 o'clock. He wouldn't know anything about it. Now let's look at it the other way. If this is the case, then is there a process by which we could simply tell a fellow, postulate some time, postulate some more time, postulate some more time, postulate some more time? Yeah, there's such a postulate. There is such a process. It's one of the more rugged processes you'd want to undertake. It's not one of the basic six processes. It's too rugged. You put this process around there. You put this process around some neurotic PC, something like that, you're going to have time on your hands, because he hasn't got any on his. It's just like there's a very silly process, a very interesting process, whereby you have a person who is having mechanical difficulties. You know, they go out and they start a motor, and then it kills, and they start it again, and it kills, they start it again, and it kills. And then they run down their battery, and then it won't run at all. And then they get the battery charged up again, and then they make sure that they don't get the oil changed, or they make sure that the wrong oil goes in, or something's going to happen, so they start the motor and it kills, and start it and kills. There are such people around. We have the organization occasionally, and the machinery doesn't operate in their vicinity. We had one recently. It's quite amusing. Machinery just didn't operate around this fellow. And so he's not handling it anymore. Anyhow, we didn't bother to run this process on him. We should have. The HASI, to some slight degree, is the case of the cobbler's children. They never have shoes. So here we have this process. We took it out of a person whose case has always been a little bit boggy. We found out he had a little difficulty with this, so we didn't care what we did to him, because it was just investigation we were conducting. We pegged his, where everybody becomes expendable in that particular deal. So we took this process and handed the fellow an object and said, how many problems can this object be to you? See, of course, this immediately ties in with the automobile that won't start, the machines that won't run, and so forth. He has a scarcity of problems as far as objects are concerned. So how many problems can this object be to you? Well, this fellow went on, and he was audited several hours on this process, and at the end of that time, he opined like it could be an awful lot of problems to him. He finally came to that consideration. There could be quite a lot of problems. He didn't think it could be an infinity of problems yet, but it was the end of the auditing session, and the auditor turned him loose and then didn't get around to him again for about 2 weeks. This fellow had nightmares. This fellow had the most difficult time he ever saw, with his breathing, with his heart action. He just was having a ball with the Thetans or machinery, see? We at least brought him up to a point where he didn't think he was going to have any. We just brought him up to a point where he didn't think he could have any more problems. We weren't going to allow him to have any more problems, evidently, with material objects. So therefore, he was going to take his own machinery and he was really going to fix it up. Now, most Thetans are in this state. They're gumming up their Thetan machinery. Their machinery cannot be enough problems to them. Well, we just went back with the old adage, you see, that the process that turns on a somatic will turn it off. And we went back, took exactly the same object in the same auditing room, and continued the process for another 15 hours. How many problems can this object be to you? And this individual was in foul condition. See, we didn't have any business running such a process on him at all. With investigation, as I said, you have to find out where processes won't work. And what do you know? What do you know? We got away with it. We actually got away with it. It's very possible from this and two other tests that we could get away with this at every level that we applied it. But it certainly takes long enough, and it produces some of the most fantastic comlags on your lower level cases. So therefore, there are other things you can do. Even before you can run this process, you have to get him into communication, of course. Now, the individual who is having his facsimiles go wild in front of his face is getting drifting fields, is doing all sorts of weirdities of this character. Let's just put him into the bracket of how many problems can his machinery be to him. And we put him in that bracket and we find out that this is very much the case with this individual. He can't have any more problems. Nobody will let him have any more problems with material machinery. See, he isn't permitted to break any of that down or do anything wrong with it. He's supposed to make that run. And he falls back and gets covert. And he drops back and starts lousing up his own bank. And every time you have a disobeying piece of machinery, it's because the individual has. I mean, this is the reason why. I mean, we're not giving you one of a lot of stuff, because this works it out. So it must be the reason why. He just hasn't enough problems on the subject of his bank. And so he's making it do all sorts of problems to him now. Theoretical process which is offered there is what offers is tremendous variations. How many problems could Machinery beat you. Your machinery beat you. How many problems could eyesight beat you? How many problems could hearing beat you? How many problems could this, could that, anything you could think of under the sun, moon, and stars? We could run into this type of process. Well, what kind of a process is it? Where does it belong in the scale of the six basic processes? Well, oddly enough, it belongs in the first bailiwick. We've taken some real rough cases, three to be exact. It's pretty hard to find real, honest to goodness, rough cases that stay rough these days. They snap on up to just won't progress out of pure cussedness. But the guy who is really worried, who is haunted, who goes in houses and glances behind doors, who is desperately afraid he's going to fall off the sidewalk, who is certain that the federal government has his brain wired by Western Union to murder, to get all of his secrets, these guys are scarce. They get around here, they start to get into communication with them. That's the basic processes which breaks up psychosis, and that's the end of the psychotic. Now we get into communication with them, then get them into communication with walls, and psychosis is no longer a problem. It might take quite a while to do this, but actually nowhere near the estimate that you would have made in the yesterdays of Dianetics and Scientology. For instance, girl we're processing right now, we got an hour-long comlag out of her yesterday. It's a curious thing. Do you know this girl has never comlagged before? Not worth a nickel. The auditor was running this girl's machinery exclusively. So the auditor sort of took over the body, the machinery, and was running it. And this case is only about 15 or 20 hours deep. And all of a sudden we run into this hour-long com lag on 8C, opening procedure. The case just stands back and looks at this wall for 1 hour. And finally goes over and touches the wall. First time the person had touched the wall herself. See, I mean, we were getting a shift there, a very violent shift. Well, we speak of this whole thing about problems. Problems are so basic to human problems, and so basic to answers, and so basic to case solutions, that we just throw this right in there with two-way communication. I told you yesterday that a two-way communication is very necessary. The communication which has not become a two-way communication, but is still a one-way communication, will go on to the end of the universe. It'll go on forever. That is an engram bank and so forth. It should have been a two-way communication. It's only a one-way communication yet. And it's still a one-way communication until somebody audits it, because there isn't anybody there to answer anymore. You shot us. Well, let's look at the overt act motivator sequence. We're familiar with this old mechanism, you know. Guys get guilty consciences and all of this. They get guilt feelings and shame, blame, regret, all of this mechanism. We find out that an individual who is complaining about his father, 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 and his father did this and his father spanked him. I even had a preacher get so desperate because he couldn't interest me in the subject of how bad his father was, tell me that his father had been habitually practiced coitus with him from the ages of 8 till 12. And I thought, this is really going a long way. So at that time, I alerted enough, realizing that this was really getting spinny, I alerted enough to at least straight wire out the overt acts against Papa. And of course, we immediately got a flip as far as the case was concerned. This fellow changed. He knew he'd changed. He knew something had happened and so forth. We found out that about a year or so before he came to me for auditing, he had beaten his father to a bloody pulp. Father had come in, his father was drunk, and he himself had had a few drinks, and the old man by this time was about 85, and he wailed into his father, and he beat him up just for stumbling around the house, sent him to the hospital with a broken jaw. This guy had been an awfully sick mental case ever since. And his father was so bad, his father was so bad. What he was trying to do without doing it well or technically was rack up enough motivators, you see, to justify this overt act. But they were on the wrong part of the time track. Well, now, what is this overt act motivator sequence but a one-way communication? You see that? It's just a one-way communication. Now, if his father, with a broken jaw, had suddenly gotten up off the floor had picked up a club or knuckle dusters or something of the sort and worked this guy over and broken his jaw, you would have had no average factor in the incident at all.
So we broke each other's jaw. Two-way communication would have occurred.
Now, a soldier on the battlefield is very often in a happy, carefree state. He's shooting enemy troops, and he's shooting enemy troops, and he's shooting enemy troops. Supposing he found out 24 hours after he'd shot 12 enemy soldiers that the enemy had not shot anybody on his side for several days. There was an armistice or something in progress. Well, he might have shot 200 before that time, but he would go on till his old age feeling like, well, he just shouldn't have shot those 12 soldiers. I've run into cases like this. One fellow was on detached duty in World War I and had shot down a plane well after the armistice. Plane came over, flying very pretty, and the guy shot him down. No two-way communication was available there. See, the guy wasn't shooting back. Wasn't in a warlike state of mind. Well, however many things he had done before that time, that one stuck. In other words, we didn't have a two-way communication, so we had a hang-up. You can almost say then that in the absence of a two-way communication, you get a hang-up of some sort or another on the track. And there's always something waiting for that answer. The bank is waiting for the answer. The fellow racks it up waiting for the answer. Two-way communication has not occurred. So an individual on a two-way communication gets into a state where he does not expect any answer will ever occur from anybody, and where he feels no answer of any kind is expected from himself. And this is worsened by the fact that within his own machinery and within his own body, he begins to believe that no communication is ever to be expected from his bank, and therefore any communication that comes from it is a surprise or an upset. Yet, if he, out of a scarcity of living beings to talk to, goes into communication with his bank, like a prospector starts talking to burros, you know. And if he doesn't have the prospectors who take burros along with them stay fairly sane. Prospects that take no burros around, everybody knows they're crazy. There's nobody to talk to. And they go around talking to themselves. I ran into a fellow in the middle of New York, not in the middle of the Southwest, who walked into the restaurant, sat down, got up, pulled out a chair, evidently sat in, it was in the Horn and Hard Arts there on Broadway, that's just above, I think it's just above 44th, at Horn and Hard Arts on, this guy is up in the upper second floor, and this guy sat this imaginary person down and started to argue. And he got more and more violent, and he got more and more angry, and he'd wait for replies, and then he'd beat the table, and he would get more angry about this whole thing. And in the meanwhile, however, he pushed over a bowl of soup and a couple of other items in front of this imaginary person, and then finally pulled them back and wouldn't let the other person, quote unquote, have the bowl of soup. And he got more and more violent and more and more violent, and he finally picked up his own chair by the top and brought it down with a crash on the empty chair. Got his overcoat and flounced out. Most terrific conversation I think in my life. Must have been a two-way communication of some kind or another. You could attribute this simply to this fact. Somewhere in that man's life, there was a tremendous scarcity of communication. Now, what happens when a person loses an ally? Let's take book one. What happens when a person loses an ally? There's no further communication with that ally, is there? So this is real bad, isn't it? We get a stop of communication in this particular level. No more conversation with the departed ally. This would be perfectly all right if there were other terminals around to communicate with, but supposing one had only been in good two-way communication with this one ally, huh? And then there were no other people around there to talk with, which made a great scarcity of communication. The individual hang on this ally, and later on, still lacking people to talk to, the individual will very likely conjure up the ally or a mythical person to stand in his vicinity to talk to. You'll hear them later on having guardian angels and all kinds of mock-ups of this character. Well, a Thetan starts talking to his own machinery. He's in bad shape. Because that machinery is never going to answer back anything more than...
What do you put in it?
Now, he could go right ahead and duplicate somebody. You know, he could make another being, endowed with full facilities and so forth, and have somebody to talk to. But he doesn't do this. He's lost the facility, or he believes there's too much life on Earth or something of the sort. And he'll start talking to his machinery. And you get a guy that's self-auditing. He's triggering some sort of a machine, and then it triggers back at him. And then he triggers at it, and it triggers back at him. There's nothing happening there. I mean, it'll just go on forever. Until eventually the machine breaks down or something occurs. Because it isn't a two-way communication. It's a one-way communication. And he knows it as well as anybody else. So the situation, I said we've gone forever, it's incorrect. The situation would break down somewhere. The machine would get bad off, the machine would break, something, your boy would get occluded. Something is liable to occur here. Why? Because of a one-way communication. Let's look at the condition. Well, let's look at something I'm very intimately acquainted with. Data on the subject of the human mind. I was not even vaguely in any poor position on this subject in 1932 simply because I didn't know that the data was missing in the textbooks and library to a very marked degree was missing. The case histories which had been accumulated, the data which had been amassed and so forth, had all been very, very carelessly done. This was a horrible botched job. But I didn't know it in 1932. I went on in the happy way that everybody was going to communicate with me on the subject if I communicated with them. And then I started talking to psychologists. One-way communication. That's a horrible state of affairs. I know nothing drearier than trying to sell a psychologist on the idea that something can be done for the mind. Or to it. He's in the darndest state of defeat you ever saw in your life. He'll give you all sorts of arguments, authorities, cast-offs of one kind or another, but they all amount to the same thing. He knows nobody can be doing it. He'll give you a bunch of sales talk, maybe, but he basically is talking from a defeated point of view. So you don't have a terminal if you yourself know you're just getting along famously on the subject and somebody else isn't. Well, a one-way communication is a liability as long as you do not know the rules and laws underlying one-way and two-way communication. And it ceases to be a liability. Inguana had a student over in London a long time ago come up to me after a lecture and he says to me, "My God, Ron, how can you go on talking on this subject and so forth? I suddenly realized that nobody ever talks to you from the same duplicated point." Well, I says, "But they do." No, they don't. Well, all right, what's the matter? Well, he says, he was talking about a one-way flow and its difficulties and so forth, and you're an example of it. Is that right? No. Well, why aren't you an example of it? Because I know what a one-way flow is, of course. How could I possibly be upset about it? And as a matter of fact, these days, here, a very recent time, auditors working in the field of the mind, working along this line, have gotten so darn smart that there isn't even vaguely a one-way communication going these days. But knowing the mechanism takes the curse off of anything. The only way the stage magician can interest or befog his audience, so on, is by doing something quickly that is evidently against the agreement of the audience, you see. And then the audience sits there and boggles and will worry about that trick. How did he make those elephants disappear? See, probably, if it was really as spectacular as that, two elephants were standing out there in the middle of the stage, and all of a sudden they weren't there, why, you would have people going out talking about this and talking about it. They still talk about Houdini getting out of boxes underneath water and so forth. How did he do these things? And, of course, Houdini wrote a book, and like Edgar Allan Poe, never told any of the secrets of his trade. The very silliest thing in the world is somebody like Edgar Allan Poe or Houdini actually sitting down to write a book on exactly how he does it. People knowing that, look at anybody in the field of development or research and so on, and they get suspicious of them. They say, well, now look, he couldn't really possibly be telling you what he's doing. But in view of the fact that the stage is not set here simply to produce phenomena, you see, and befog and bedazzle, we have a rather comfortable time of it. Nothing very horrible takes place. But it certainly could, you see, if there was this sleight of hand, behind the scenes kind of activity going on. Well, very often a student is so accustomed to somebody who does know something, doing so much of this sleight of hand stuff, you know. There you see the Jack of Spades, you know, and there you see the King of Hearts, and I have no cards. And you see, they're not my sleeves. And he's used to being befogged like this. So he's always looking to be told something fantastic or fabulous, you see, that just breaks down everything else that's been said. So as a matter of fact, then he begins to discount everything that's been taught on the subject, you see, and waits for a single trick or something of the sort that really was the trick. Well, he gets caught in the same mechanism of watching Houdini, you see, something of the sort. Houdini is there to befuddle them, to upset them. One way or another, and stick them on the track. Forget that. Houdini's there to stick them on the track. Don't forget that when you examine the subject of interest. The fellow who is trying to be very, very interesting, and who is himself being capable of being interested, is only interested in sticking somebody, stopping them. It's fascinating. Fascinating thing. Let's get back to this one-way flow. Now, no one-way flow is possible here. In every unit that has gone through, I have learned thoroughly as much from the students as they've learned from me. This is a cinch. This is why we get modifications. Basic theory is not altered, but application has, thoroughness of application. What can the student learn? All kinds of bric-a-brac and so forth has altered. You're getting the benefit right now of a great many clinical units in which this has been thoroughly hacked over. This isn't a one-way communication we're doing here, and don't think of it in that fashion. But the thing that sticks this trick is the fact that it's a one-way communication. The second you know exactly how he made the two elephants disappear, there's no longer any stuck, is there? So there's that mechanism senior to this mechanism of a stuck flow or a one-way communication. If you understood the mechanisms attendant to a one-way communication and a two-way communication, if you understood these thoroughly, you'd never stick on a one-way communication. Everything is basically consideration. These are the basic considerations which go to make up the track. There must be a two-way communication is one of them. We don't know why. Except there just is. Everybody's got that consideration. See, there should be a two-way communication. All right, so if they don't know the mechanisms of communication, then they are subject to this one-way communication mechanism. So they've looked at MEST. Let me show you some examples of this. They've looked at MEST and looked at MEST and looked at MEST. Does it ever look at them? Occasionally a mirror does. That's about all. That's about all. Once in a while a river does. It's very quiet. Lake. But has it really looked at them? All right, you've given the body orders. You've given it 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 orders. Is anything around the body who will give anything else any orders, really? Not unless we invent some. Not unless we invent some. We can then say, look how this body's giving me orders. It's moving me around in time and place. It's doing all this sort of thing. You know, no responsibility. This is just subsequent to the stuck flow, one-way communication. See, we get a one-way communication, a one-way communication, a one-way communication. Eat, sleep, walk, make love, smile, dance, move, sit still, eat, sleep, dress, brush your teeth, da, da, da. See, always just one way. Does the body ever say, well, I don't know whether I'll brush my teeth? Has it ever said to you, Satan, brush your teeth. Not unless you said it first. Mirror trick, see? Mirror trick. Now, you actually could make the body talk back to you. Apparently. By picking up an old-time facsimile of what you said to the body. Or that somebody said to it. You can make a page talk to you, similarly. Somebody said something to the page, so now the page can say something to you, but you know that isn't the case. It isn't basic flow, light to light. Unless you really realize that you're talking with Epicurus or somebody when he wrote on that page. You see, if you get into the silly notion that the page is talking to you, you'll get your nose stuck in a book, just literally, see? The bibliophile, he collects books. He's collected books. What do they say? He doesn't know. I went into a movie star's home one time. And this person had evidently been collecting books. There was a library of considerable size. Boy, did he have books in it. And so forth. And I thought, well, gee, that's just dandy. I am going to have a good time over this weekend after all. And a nice quiet place around here to read books. So I reached up, poor fool that I am, to pull one of these books off the shelf. They were all dummies. They were just the backs. Millions of backs, the place had in it, evidently. Anyhow, just like the girl. So, nothing but backs. You might remember that star, but I won't give her away. The point here is that one-way communication will stick somebody. Now, this is a basic cardinal rule. You don't know all the mechanisms of communication. You don't know what communication is all about. You don't know what two-way communication is all about. You don't realize that communication will hang up. The way people stick is determined by the one-way flow. This is the stuck mechanism. It's a one-way flow with no reply. And that is a stick. That's how a person gets into a body. That is how a person gets to be a denizen of Earth. That is how a person gets into this system, or this galaxy, or this universe. The one thing which this universe does not do is answer back. It makes you answer yourself back when you are talking to it. And an individual can make the mistake of talking to it, not through it. Now, I can talk to you through the physical universe with perfect equanimity and with no slightest average upset. I'm talking to you. You're alive, you're capable of self-determinism, even pan-determinism of thought. A belief, you could make postulates, you can make them stick, you can create machinery. You have all of these capabilities. Talking to you, sooner or later, I will get a reply. Even if you just look at me, I'm getting a reply. See? But talking to that stuff over there, see, that wall, that's a lot different. See? And if an individual is stupid enough to expect it to answer, if he ever makes this, it's actually just one little consideration on the track. It is just one particular type of consideration. It is, the physical universe must answer back, or this rock has got to answer me back, see? He's just got to make that mistake and then keep on making it. And boy, does he get stuck. See, he'll stick right there. Zoom. That's the only way anybody ever gets stuck, except by the consideration that he is stuck. Now, the consideration that he is stuck, of course, is the senior consideration. But the mechanics of getting stuck, on which we have agreed, and they're only valid because we agreed on them, we voted it for them or something, is that a one-way communication will stick somebody, and that is why a person gets stuck in a body. It's why a person who's out of a body goes back into a body. Let's say, here's a hypothetical, or maybe not so hypothetical, incident. Expedition is about to take off and invade this small moon which is passing around this planet. Okay? A Thetan who knows all about this expedition, who lives on that small moon and considers life very nice up there, and so on, objects to this expedition. So he goes down and he spots the expedition leader, and he says, zap fashion,
"I told you, I'm messing up this whole black season."
He bangs on into the head of the expedition leader and completes the expedition himself.
Why? Why did he do this?
Later on, we'll think of it as one of his better accomplishments. What happened to the expedition leader? He probably banged on out the other side. But he certainly never got into contact with the expedition leader. He was only in contact with that body, and that body and anything else around that body, as far as he could tell, did not answer back. And he expected an answer back of exact violence of the answer addressed. And the answer addressed was a violent statement, and there was no reply. And so one-way communication had occurred. One-way communication so thorough that he deteriorized. So therefore, time and again on the time track, he put a beam or made a statement to a body and then gone on inside it. Now you'll notice this, you see that it comes basically out of this basic error that mest can answer you and that bodies are alive. They're as alive as they're run. But they're a machine built by Thetans for the operation of Thetans. By the Thetans for the people of the bodies. There's the mechanism of sudden interiorization. There is the mechanism of entrapment, of course, the basic mechanism that frees all entrapments is understanding. I was going into that yesterday. You understand something, it certainly can't trap you. Well, one-way communication can't trap you either if you understand it. You know what it is. You say, look here, now this is a basic agreement that I have made, and that if I communicate one way and I don't get an answer, then I have to close terminals with something and do the answering myself. That's the basic thing. So a guy gets married or buried or something and lives unhappily for years with his character, and you come in, this fellow comes in, he's all cheerful, you know, and he says, "I just bought a new hat. How does this look?" "Dear, I just bought a new hat. How does it look?" "Close the door, Henry." "After a while, you will see this fellow with some feminine gestures." "How does this come about?" "Well, he has to go over there and answer himself." All right, he loses this wife by smallpox or divorce or something. And years later, your process is a preclear. You say to him, "All right, now let's get something you wouldn't mind remembering." "Duh." "No." He's answering. The situation has gotten complex to this degree. How do you answer if you're the wife? By being silent, of course. Isn't this goofy? That's how you answer, by being silent. It's this business all over again. It's safe to do whatever your parents did. This is trial, error, natural selection, evolution, everything. It's one of the things that life does along the track. It's safe to do what your parents did. By the way, a little child would dramatize this, and unless their parents have been terribly neglectful, just abysmally neglectful, well, they'll get into this fascinating state. They will momentarily and cursorily imitate a maid or a governess or something. Just momentarily. Nothing. It's not safe. They'll go right on imitating their parents. And it's quite a curious thing. They'll imitate their parents. It's safe to do what your parents did. You see that? Now, I have smoked this out. It's a very interesting little discovery. I actually conducted a few little tests on this.
and did a lot of talking around and asking the questions.
Curious thing. A baby will eat off of his mother's plate almost anything. One of the more fiendish tests that I conducted on this was on my own kid. I wouldn't have done it somebody else's kid. I pretended to scatter an enormous amount of pepper into the palm of my hand and then pretended to eat it with some relish. I didn't scatter any pepper at all. Handed it to my little girl. She probably threw some pepper into the palm of her hand and ate it with considerable relish. And for some days was busy enjoying pepper in great quantity. I got her maid, the maid, to put some pepper in her hand and eat it. Neither accelerated nor decelerated the child's. Now, she'd been eating with the maid most of the time. All right, went a little bit further than that. Got the maid to take some cabbage, cut it, eat it, and then cut it, eat it again. She didn't care anything about that cabbage. Nothing. I took some cabbage and ate it, and cabbage was fine. So I tracked up on this further and found out why the children made such a clamor at the table. Most parents would love to find this out. Why are children so clamorous around a table? Well, it's because, actually, that's the thing that's safe to eat. They want to be in there with their parents during mealtime. It's safe to eat with parents. Well, the only thing I'm making point of this is just to give you another silly example of the rationale of life. If the parents die, it is then safe to die. Let's follow this. It is safe to do what your parents do is the basic postulate. So what happens to some kid whose parents are dead? He's dead. And there's another one of your key pre-clears whose case is hanging up all over the place. He's doing what is safe. He's doing the secure thing, the safe thing. This is one of the 75 processes, by the way. All right, let's look over this and discover this, that if you actually knew the mechanisms behind one-way and two-way communication, that they wouldn't bother you, not even vaguely. You wouldn't stick just because somebody didn't answer. You wouldn't switch valence just because somebody didn't answer you. You would know that people were switching valence, though, because they weren't being answered. And you would know that many people were sticking on the subject of mess because they expected walls and things to answer them. Completely irrational. One of their own postulates. Some game they played sometime or another. They get out of their body and they stick to the wall. They put a beam on the wall and they can't get the wall, the beam on. Well, that's because they expect the wall to put a beam back at them if they put a beam on the wall. You get the idea? Nothing sillier than this. Now, there's a little neurotic boy who comes to mind who used to beat his wagon and kick rocks. And a lot of children will do this. They walk up to a rock, the rock will stub them or something, you know, and they'll kick the rock. And they'll have an awful argument with that rock. See, big argument with the rock. Actually, they get stuck to the rock, only we know how they get stuck to the rock. They carry a somatic of the kick. That is getting stuck to the rock. Now, do you understand? And that is a facsimile. Person wouldn't have any facsimiles. We never expected this stuff to answer. He makes it answering by making a picture and then looking at the picture. And then saying it's that picture. Well, now this is facsimiles. This is the stuck phrase. This is the stuck change valence. This is the rest of us, see? All around the clock here. This is the mechanism we've been playing with book one. It's the stuck communication. So if you don't understand anything else, for God's sake, understand two-way communication, exactly how it works, exactly how it sticks. And look very, very, look very closely at the world around you here in the next few days. Pick yourself up some independently discovered examples of people doing a one-way communication, getting stuck by it.
You see it, it happens all the time. Happens all the time. You understand this thoroughly, it's merely because they expect an answer back. But who is it that's expecting the answer back, huh? It's the person himself. Do you know that if you never expected an answer back from something, it's not aberrative? This isn't a mechanism that sneaks up on you. I mean, it's one of those horribly, it's like a corpse lying in the center of the town, busiest street. Yeah, it's right there in sight. I don't know why I would have just not answered my letter. I wrote her last Tuesday. She hasn't answered, she hasn't answered. I want to know. I want to know if she's coming here and she isn't. What do you suppose has gotten into her? What's the next action? To close the terminals. With a what? With a telephone, at least. All right, now we have two offices. Somebody sends me a dispatch. This is easy to do these days because I'm doing practically nothing but trying to get rid of this book and try not to take care of too many administrative details. And somebody sends me a dispatch. No answer. Look at it, it's not an important dispatch. It's not going to gum any wheels. I might have seen it, might not have seen it. But it's stuck, anyhow. Their next action is to come to 806. See? Close the terminal. You see that? If you don't get an answer, you have to come there. And the next action after that, this one you would really consider nutty, would be for the person to write his own answer on his own dispatch and then go back to 616 to wait for the dispatch to be returned to him so he would know what I had said. See, that would be the next answer. That'd be real nutty, wouldn't it? Well, how about the fellow coming up from 616, writing the answer on the dispatch, and thereafter being me? And sending this dispatch back to himself, who is no longer there at 616. You're looking at psychosis when you look at that. That is psychosis. That's exactly what the psychotic is doing. So the answer to this is obviously communication. It's actually with the factors of affinity, the factors of agreement, reality thrown in. Good old ARC, better understood. That is exactly what is going on with your pre-clear, and the remedy for it is to remedy his scarcity of communication, to get him into communication, to let him discover that there is another terminal around someplace. And that he himself is talking to the mess and he's expecting the answer back from it. He's getting his answer back from it. Hey, opening CJC, just make him go, you know, touch that. He'll run out the postulate after a while that he's expecting this stuff to answer. Doesn't answer. These guys that have these big massive ridges, that have lots of facsimiles, what are they doing? They just run a stuck flow, that's all, at energy masses and so on. Now they're being the energy mass. It never answered back. How about the fellow who's occluded? We would say offhand that he must have talked to some black energy masses at some time or another. He'd done a lot of talking to the night with no answer back. Remember the song, Chloe? All right. So the first and foremost thing that we have here on our agenda is a good, solid grasp of this two-way communication, the mechanism of getting stuck, and how it results in facsimiles, shifted valences, being in bodies, getting stuck to walls, so forth. There's lots and lots of processes that could be run on this subject. Give me something you don't expect any answer from. Give me something you expect answers from. I mean, any kind of process you could rig up. Curious thing, in present time or otherwise, liable to do almost anything to the pre-clear. Make them worse, make them better, do something or other. If you ran any of these long enough, however, it'd always make them better. All right? And that's the only way you can make a pre-clear worse with a process is to stop running it. That's a horrible fact. Now, the basic modus operandi of existence, so forth. The Thetan stops duplicating himself, stops putting up sentient, thinking, self-determined beings just like himself, just by postulate, starts making machinery, starts expecting it to answer, gets stuck with his own machinery bank, starts expecting people around him to answer, starts expecting bodies to give him answers. He'd run into most anybody in the street, they would swear that the person that's going to answer them is the body standing in front of them, and that is not the person who's answering. And Satan was there answering. No matter how bogged down he is, this is still what's happening. And so we get two-way communication as the resolution of this. So therefore, all processes, no matter how involved or how simple they might be, are dependent upon the first process used, which is on the lowest part of the tone scale, on up. It goes from the lowest level we can reach on up. It's two-way communication. That's the first process we got to study, look at, and so forth. A good way to go about it is to do some straight wire. That's another process, you see, but you still get in conversation on a sudden. You still have the fellow having his bank answering and so forth. All right. The main thing we're interested in is an utter, complete, and devastatingly clear concept of exactly how two-way communication results in steps. One-way communication results in steps, and how two-way communication can resolve this. See this clearly, where there isn't any problem in theory or anything else that can ever baffle you. Nothing could baffle you in a Prinkler's case. He, of course, being incomprehensible, because any terminal that doesn't answer is then incomprehensible, all sorts of things. It's the Prinkler himself who expects the answer. It is the expectancy of the answer which makes the aberration take place. You as an auditor could only be re-stimulated if you kept expecting the answer from the pre-clear, expecting the answer from the pre-clear, without understanding the mechanism back of answers. Many a person's going around looking for the answer to existence when he only wanted his mother to say hello. That was the basic line, you see. He wants the answer to his mother, and then his mother gets out into everything else, and you have associative logic, you've got reasoning, and you finally get him expecting, and you finally find him at Cornell studying mathematics or something in order to get the answer. Get the idea? Okay, so that is our most basic chore right now, is in auditing and in the environment around and about. Let's look over this very carefully and see if we can see some examples of people trying to remedy one-way communication by answering themselves, by any other mechanism we can notice in the field of communication. Okay?